Walking around the more devastated parts of inner city Christchurch recently, I came across the deserted remains of what used to be called the Avon Motor Lodge, one of the better venues for wedding receptions, as I recalled it. And a memory came back of a wedding I'd taken when I was the vicar of St Mary's Addington. It had all gone rather smoothly. The wedding breakfast was in a rather better place than usual, this motor lodge, and so I relaxed as I arrived and prepared to enjoy the meal. Until the photographer came over, leaned over my shoulder and said, "They've done nothing about toasts, providing an MC, or making speeches, so you are it and you had better organise it all." So I rose to my feet in one of the more stressed and impromptu performances of my life. When I think about the wedding at Cana of Galilee, I wonder if the couple concerned had the same issue or the same problem as this Christchurch couple. They focused all their attention on the front end of things, the actual wedding itself, and had forgotten the crucial details about the reception, which is why it ended up in a rather under-organised way, in which they had failed to think through with tough-minded realism about the drinking habits of their friends and family. What a very odd miracle this first sign in John's Gospel is, on a number of counts. First of all, many of the people there only learn about the miracle, almost inadvertently, towards the end of the story, when the steward announces that a large quantity of high-quality wine has been discovered in an unlikely place. And then there's the vast oversupply of wine itself, something like 20 to 30 gallons worth, far more than the wedding guests can actually drink. And then there's that very rude exchange between mother and son that takes place at the front end of the story, and that rather kind of disturbs the fact that the Holy Family was held up for our admiration just a few Sundays ago. Here's a precocious child and mother story that seems rather less than edifying. And when we start thinking about the theological meaning of this miracle, things become even more puzzling again. I mean, most miracles in the New Testament are exhibitions of divine power to meet situations of human need. Desperate people being rescued from a storm, a child being drawn back from the brink of death to be restored to its parents, people with horrible debilitating illnesses given health or sight restored. There's nothing about like this in this particular miracle. It just seems to be without that particular motivation to meet real human need. The worst that could have happened in this situation would have been social embarrassment by the bride and groom and the guests returning home rather more sober than they expected. And I guess the story leaves us, but it's a story with lots of loose ends, messy, like life itself. It can't be kind of tied up into a neat meaning. It's full of the uncontrollable narrative richness of life. And it leaves us asking questions about the kind of God who stands behind this world and the kind of world that we are in. And the truth is that when God made the world, the act of creation was creating something other than himself, which apparently he rejoices in and delights in and takes pleasure in. You know, most of the creation is even unaware of the hidden ground of love that stands behind it. Most sentient beings aren't aware of that which holds it in being. But God appears just to like the world and not to feel he needs to feed off it or use it as an advertising sign or kind of write himself all over the world. That's why I put on the front cover of this morning's Pebble that poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins, because the punchline that kind of supports what the sermon is about, whereas Hopkins says, "Each mortal thing does one thing and the same. Myself it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came." So God lets the world be itself. God doesn't want to be everything in it. And God just enjoys it and asks for what it is. And in this January holiday season, there'll be plenty of celebrations and plenty of just enjoying people for what they are. And I guess we're being invited to take that same disinterested appreciation of them. And the final point I want to leave you with this is one that the Anglo-Catholic theologian Austin Farrer made. He talked about in one of his sermons about what we should do when we're praying for people we love who don't share the Christian faith, and we just love them to share that faith that lights up our life. He said, don't go around saying, make them a Christian, make them a Christian, make them a Christian, as if God was going to impose belief on them, whether they liked it or not. He said, pray for this person, asking God that the very best things in them will be let out. The best things about them will come to fruition and full development. And ask that their autonomy, their consistency will become more fully revealed. The deep fact about who God made them to be will come into clear relief with all the encouragement that that's needed. And if this happens, then perhaps it will become likely that they would freely choose to love God. Well, I suppose the last thought I want to leave you with is that God apparently is rather interested in and good at viticulture and wine production. And so wine buffs are left with two tormenting questions at the end of this story. As Capernaum Estates 31 was served on the table, was this the best wine that had ever been produced in humankind's history? Was it a red or a white? Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.